Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Congress finally passed a credit card reform law this week. That means big changes for the companies that let us charge it. But will it do anything for your debt right now?
It doesn't say that credit card companies can't charge you a higher interest rate. It just moves forward with a notion that I don't think is radical, that they have to tell you about it ahead of time.
Vilifying credit is easy these days, but some people are thankful for the plastic that got them through lean times.
But in my salad days, I used credit cards not just for actual salad at the supermarket, but for grad school tuition fees, doctor bills, and, keeping it classy, cash advances for the rent.
Those were her salad days? And what happens when you grow up with only a bull market? You are not ready for the bears.
You don't really get the point that you could get wiped out in a matter of days, not months, but days.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. We love you, now change. That was the message to our credit cards this week. Good thing they're made of plastic. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at Thrivent.com.
President Barack Obama signed the credit reform bill on Friday. Supporters and detractors alike say it signals a new era in credit cards. So for those of you who haven't quite absorbed the details of this law, we asked our colleagues here at Marketplace to read the fine print.
Prohibits over-the-limit fees unless a cardholder elects to be allowed to go over a limit.
Gift cards will be valid for 5 years.
Customers have to receive 45 days' notice before their rates are increased.
Prohibits retroactive rate increases unless the cardholder is at least 60 days behind in paying the bill.
Lenders must post their credit card agreements on the internet.
Bans pay-to-pay fees, which are charged when someone pays the bill by phone or on the internet.
Anyone under 21 must prove they can repay the money before getting a card.
Lenders must say how expensive a balance would be if only the minimum payments are made.
People can now carry loaded guns in national parks and wildlife refuges.
May we suggest next time you're in a national park that you use your credit card for target practice? Well, now joining us to discuss the new law is Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. Glad to have you on the program, Senator, so we can perhaps give credit where credit is due.
Oh, that's a good pun, I guess, to begin the conversation here. I thank you very much. 20 years in the making. I started out on this issue literally 2 decades ago, and when I first offered this legislation as part of the so-called bankruptcy reform bill, I think I got about 30 votes, something like that, for it. And finally, I think the culmination of it really began to sink in about a year ago when the industry raised interest rates on 70 million accounts, one in four families. And I think that's really the tipping point, and that's why we were able to prevail as strongly as we did with a 90-5 vote in the Senate.
Well, why do you think it took so long? Why didn't we all as consumers get madder sooner?
Because the economy was so good. I think a lot of people never even looked. I think people were paying minimum balances and didn't realize their interest rates had jumped in some cases from 5, 6, 7% to 20, 28%. And just kept on writing a check to pay the minimum balance. And then as the economy went bad, people began to lose jobs. People began to look more closely at this. And the rates began to be increased arbitrarily without even doing anything wrong. They were just jumping rates. We had a case of a woman in Connecticut. Her rate went from 5% to 24%, despite having had a long track record with them for almost 30 years.
You know, one of the concerns in the Wall Street crisis is that if you crack down on one practice, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. They'll just find another way to make up for it. Are you concerned that despite this crackdown on the credit card industry, they're just going to find other ways to ding the consumer?
Well, they will. I mean, this is not, you don't solve all these problems forever. And anyone who thinks they've done that is making mistakes. So we've never done anything like this before with the credit card industry. It's the only contractual relationship I know of where one party can arbitrarily change the conditions at any point in the contract. But this much I'll say, the next steps will come, and I don't welcome this, but the idea that someone can charge as much as 30 to 35% interest rates, we came very close to actually imposing a national usury cap, and I'm very close to endorsing one myself. The industry needs to wake up, step back, take a breath, and realize that what you've been doing here has been unfair, And frankly, there are other tools in our arsenal to deal with this industry if they decide they're going to punish the consumers because they finally stood up and demanding greater accountability, greater fairness.
Well, the industry has warned that this is going to make credit more expensive, less available to the masses. First, do you think that's true? And second, could that be a good thing?
How much more expensive could it get? This argument somehow we're going to limit credit and make it less available to people. It's a very good business. Credit cards are very valuable tools for people. So there'll be issuers out there who, frankly, are going to do very well. And I think those who try to penalize consumers are going to pay a price for doing so.
Well, on the consumer side, what lessons do you think we all might take out of the credit binge?
Well, that's a very important point, because while I'm talking about rights and responsibilities by the issuers, consumers also have to exercise responsibility. One of the things we're doing in this is insisting that the instructions and the language be very clear so that people have a sound idea of what they're getting into. You know, make sure you're not taking on more responsibilities you can't. One of the things we do in this bill, you and I may remember this, not that long ago, there were credit limits. This legislation sets those limits now, unless you as a consumer want to opt out of that. And that'll help consumers as well, I think, to act more responsibly.
I hope you don't mind my asking, but I wonder if you could talk about why this is a pet issue for you. I mean, you know, do you use credit cards?
Oh, yeah.
Do you carry a balance, may I ask?
Yeah, no, and I've as I told you, I've exceeded my balance from time to time.
Yeah.
But I try to be careful about it, as I think most people try to be. But when you're all sorts of economic activities can occur that can put pressure on you, and credit cards can help, but we all have to be careful about it.
Senator Christopher Dodd, thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you for you. Happy Memorial Day to everyone.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. American Public Media programs explore the American dream and ask, after our current troubles are over, what's next? More at nextamericandream.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So what exactly will all this mean for you once it takes effect in about 9 months? For some perspective, we've brought in several voices from the debate. Susanna Montezemolo is with the Center for Responsible Lending. Nessa Fedis represents the American Bankers Association. And Robert Manning is author of the book Credit Card Nation. Welcome, Susanna.
Thank you so much, Tess.
And Nessa Fedis, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
And Robert Manning.
Pleasure to be joining you.
Susanna, let me start with you. There are many things missing from this bill that consumer organizations wanted. There's no cap on interest rates. I don't think the House provision requiring the fine print to be in at least 12-point font made it into the final bill. Does this law do the job?
This is a really fantastic law, and we're very pleased with it. The one thing that we would have preferred would be to have a faster implementation date, because people are really suffering in this time of recession and need help quickly.
Nessa, you represent the banks, and the credit industry has been issuing all kinds of warnings about the consequences of this law. Cards harder to get, rewards may go away, fees may return. Can you confirm that those things will happen?
With regard to the legislation, yes, our concern is that Congress didn't strike a balance, and yes, that credit cards will be harder for small businesses and people, including people who are self-employed, to be able to find credit cards. Their limits will be lower. They may find accounts closed, and interest rates will go up across the board.
But isn't it possible that some of these new rules will mean that more people will be able to pay back their debts? I mean, things like, you know, double cycle billing, retroactive interest rate hikes, that just made it harder for a lot of people to pay you back, didn't they?
No, I mean, things like the two cycle billing, that rarely, most banks didn't use that. And it only was in effect if somebody usually pays off in time in full at the end of the month, and then 1 month decides not to pay in full. So it was something that's fairly rare.
But wait, 60% of consumers don't pay off their balance in full each month. And I know, having just recently looked at my credit card, both of them use double cycle billing. And yes, it's true that in theory, one could go and find a new credit card. But when almost no cards don't have these abusive practices, there really isn't any consumer choice. And what this bill does is it creates fair rules of the road moving forward. It doesn't say that credit card companies can't charge you a higher interest rate. It just moves forward with a notion that I don't think is radical, that they have to tell you about it ahead of time.
Robert, let me turn to you now. The author of a book called Credit Nation. What will this law, do you think, mean to that nation of credit users? And I wonder if you have any thoughts on consumer responsibility here. You know, if we were all more responsible with our credit, would we need these protections?
Well, the real key issue here is there's fundamental change, both in the short term and the long term. You know, the bank's job was to say how much credit people could afford. And suddenly now the boundaries of how much credit you could have changed so radically. Many people got caught in this transitionary period, lost their jobs, and now, of course, rue the day they took on so much debt, but are asking the same question of how come I could get, you know, $100,000 in a line of credit when I only make $60,000? I think this is a real time for both groups, both the banks who are dependent on people to make money on and consumers who really don't want to go into bankruptcy, to have a wake-up call and start talking about what personal responsibility is going to mean when the average American has far more debt than they can afford. And if they focus on repaying their debt, then there's no money left over to jumpstart the economy and get out of this recession.
Nessa, I think you mentioned earlier that you thought that, you know, there were some things in this bill that perhaps should have happened. I wonder what those were and why it took legislation for the banks to kind of come around to this idea that maybe all the rules weren't working.
Well, the industry acknowledges that some cardholders found the terms of their credit card accounts confusing. Our concern is that what Congress has done will mean that interest rates will go up for everybody and that many people, many small businesses, will have difficulty getting credit cards. The limits will be lower or they may find accounts actually closed.
But Robert, let me ask you, what's the downside to limiting credit, reducing the number of people who can get it? Doesn't that just mean that people won't get what they can't afford? Isn't there some silver lining there in that maybe we won't be so dependent upon credit?
Well, that's really the discussion we need to have in our society. Basically, our economy is dependent upon 70% of consumer spending activity. It raises a whole series of questions about the future of our economy. And if we start talking about lifestyles that are based on a certain income level without this extra amount of debt, our standard of living, by definition, has to decline.
Susanna, let me conclude with you, and I wonder if you can tell us what, if anything, we might need to watch out for in the intervening months before this law takes effect. Card companies are already slashing credit limits. They're already hiking interest rates. And I wonder if we might see even more of that as the industry anticipates what's coming.
You're absolutely right, Tess. People really should look at their statements carefully and look at what fees and interest rates are being charged and not be afraid to dispute some of those fees. We do think, however, that the claims that industry is making that it will, in the long term, lead to higher costs for consumers are the same claims that they always make when regulation comes and hits them. It's been 30 years since the credit card industry was regulated, and it's about time that it happened. We think that this is going to be a new day for consumers and an area where they're really empowered and in the future will be able to make choices.
Susanna Montezemolo is with the Center for Responsible Lending. Nessa Fettes represents the American Bankers Association. And Robert Manning directs the Center for Consumer Financial Services at the Rochester Institute of Technology and is the author of the book Credit Card Nation. Thank you, all three of you, for this discussion today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tess.
Coming up, speaking of credit, we'll hear from a young woman who moved to a strange town and found herself making purchases instead of friends. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. It is another holiday weekend, and with another holiday weekend come the inevitable entreaties to come on down, we've got a deal for you.
It's Younger's Memorial Sales Event.
It's the Mike Patton Memorial Day Sales Event, and it's going on now.
Pat O'Brien Chevrolet is having a big Memorial Day sales event just like all the other deals.
There's no need to go anywhere else.
It is one tough market for car dealerships right now, but that doesn't mean it's a tough market for you. In fact, quite the opposite. Here with some perspective is our good friend Phil Reed, Senior Consumer Advice Editor for Edmunds.com. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be here.
So we're still in the midst of a credit crunch. We've heard a lot about what it's doing with mortgages, with bank accounts. What about cars?
Well, it's interesting. The word credit crunch, of course, has scared off a lot of people. So there have been a number of people who have thought, I won't be able to get finance, so I'm not even going to go car shopping. So we have to be a little careful about that. You can get credit. There are some outstanding offers on car loans right now, but it's a little harder to get qualified. And part of that is because they're trying to clean up their act.
Yeah. The big thing recently in auto financing has been these layoff protection programs where you lose your job, you don't have to make your payments. Has that changed anything for the people who are doing loans?
It may have convinced some people to buy cars. Hyundai was the first one to do it. They did it last fall, and it was very successful for them. First of all, they got a lot of media attention because it was kind of new. Nobody had tried it before. The interesting thing was not many people took them up on their offer. So a lot of people bought cars, but not many people brought them back. This convinced Ford, Chrysler, and GM to try their own programs, which were introduced about a month ago.
So should we equate that if you buy a car, you won't lose your job?
Maybe it's good luck, yes.
Right. How are people behaving when it comes to buying a car these days? Do you see people, I don't know, holding back a little more, keeping their cars longer?
Oh, yeah, definitely. They're keeping their cars longer. They're fixing up their older cars. They're just making do.
And that's a bit ironic because isn't it actually a good time to buy a car? Aren't there quite a few deals out there, a bit of a buyer's market?
Well, it's for bargain hunters, it's a great time to buy a car. One of the things that slowed people down a little bit is there may be new things coming. For example, the Cash for Clunkers program. Some people may have heard about that, and they're waiting to cash in on it.
And this is where the Obama administration has suggested that there may be a plan where you can bring in your car that gets terrible mileage and buy a new car that has a lot better mileage, and you will get a tax break based on the difference.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it could really play into some people's hands. I mean, some people that have a very old car that's a gas guzzler that's not worth hardly anything are guaranteed of getting up to $4,500 toward the purchase of a new car. So it could play really well for some people, particularly for truck owners, for people that want to trade their truck in. And the idea is it's going to boost the fuel economy, take some polluters off the road, and also stimulate the economy.
I also want to ask you, you know, it's been about a year since we first started to see these big spikes in gasoline prices, and everybody was talking about how fuel efficiency was going to be the word of the day. Nobody could get rid of their SUVs anymore, sell them on the market. Has that changed now since gas prices have come down to more normal levels?
Yes. I mean, last summer, about the only things that were selling were hybrids and small cars.
Right.
I mean, it almost completely wiped out the truck and SUV market. I mean, it's just incredible how quickly people forget. There seems to be this default position where they believe that gas is going to be affordable and plentiful forever. And as soon as the problem gets fixed, you know, and the fix is low gas prices, people go back into those categories.
Final question. You guys do all kinds of ratings on cars and trucks and all kinds of automobiles. So what are you recommending these days?
Well, we're on the verge of seeing fully electric cars for the first time. Nissan next year will bring one out. Of course, we have some Teslas on the road right now, and the Mini E is coming out. We're hoping to get one of those at Edmunds.com.
The electric Mini. Yeah.
The electric Mini. So we could, if people want to wait and wait about a year and a half, there will be electric cars available.
Really? That soon?
Well, everybody's saying the end of next year is going to be when it comes out because also GM's got the Chevy Volt, which has been talked about for a long time. That's not fully electric. It's a plug-in electric hybrid. And so those are some cars that will be very exciting. We have quite an abundance of very good hybrids. For example, the Ford Fusion Hybrid has been getting very good reviews. It's a midsize sedan. So other than those cars, there really hasn't been a lot of movement in the market. There haven't been a lot of new and exciting products coming out, but that's where a lot of the action is.
Phil Reed is with Edmunds.com. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Car loans, credit cards, it is easy to get in over your head. And Sabrina Regal did just that. She moved to Southern California a couple of years ago. Without lots of friends, but with plenty of free time, Regal racked up massive amounts of credit card debt. Here's a short story of how she deleveraged her life.
When I moved down here, I didn't know anyone. I didn't have any friends. And I think that's why I used shopping as to fill that void. I had, gosh, about seven credit cards. It was just stupid stuff, you know what I mean? Just buying a lot of clothes, shoes, frivolous things. I sat down one day and just took all my bills and realized that I was $40,000 in credit card debt. And I thought, oh my God. I wasn't always able to make the minimum payment. And when people were calling me, I felt like there was a part of me that was very private that all of a sudden I'm totally exposed. And it felt humiliating. The credit counseling service fixed all that, and I thought it was going to be very bleak. Like, we're going to take all your money, and we're just going to put it toward your credit cards, and you're going to be left with $50 a month for food, gas, everything else, you know. And I thought I would be eating top ramen every night. When I talked to the counselor, he said to me, he's like, you know what, this really isn't that bad. You're going to pay this off in 3 years, and you're going to save tens of thousands of dollars in interest payments. I just was blown away how quickly they brought down the interest rates on all my cards. I mean, I had some cards that were about like 26%, and they got them down to 9. There's that sense of control, too. I have a really strict budget. I know exactly what goes into my account every month and everything that goes out. I look for sale items at the grocery store. Before, I didn't care. I had to have that name brand ketchup. Now it's like, you know, well, the store brand's on sale. It's cheaper, you know. I'm going to try it. I'm not crazy in terms of buying things anymore. I don't have that lust or that urge anymore. You know, I changed the way I look at life. I changed the way I look at my future. I don't use it anymore to fill a void, I guess.
That was Los Angeles resident Sabrina Regal. She told her debt reduction story to Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith. We wish Sabrina lots of luck with her personal deleveraging. She is certainly not alone in that effort, but that doesn't mean everyone is down on plastic. In fact, as a country, our revolving debt totaled $955 billion in February. Commentator Megan Daum says maybe that's not such a bad thing.
Debt, my father used to say, is the American way of life. He wasn't condoning this, merely pointing it out with the same austere detachment you heard in that famous line from The Graduate, one word, plastics. Still, I took my dad literally. By the time I was 25, I'd acquired no less than 7 credit cards. And granted, in my 20s, I did have some credit card balances that outlasted even my longest relationships. But if you'll forgive my honesty, I'd like to offer up a defense of credit cards. Sure, they can ruin lives, but occasionally they can save them too, or at least help out. Don't try this at home, kids, but in my salad days, I used credit cards not just for actual salad at the supermarket, but for grad school tuition fees, doctor bills, tax payments, household utilities, and, keeping it classy, cash advances for the rent. Okay, not great. But still, thanks to those cards, I was able to pay my professional dues in ways that would have been impossible without them. In other words, even though I did plenty of paid work, I could sometimes take on unpaid work that would lead to bigger things. It wasn't an ideal strategy, but in lieu of underwriting from my family or the NEA, it was the only one I had. Of course, credit was easier to come by in the 1990s. Good luck to the artist who tries to finance his book research or documentary film with a stack of Visa cards today. As President Obama said recently, excess is out of fashion. And though he was talking to bank executives, he might as well have been talking to all of us. But what goes out of style eventually becomes trendy again. And despite the hard lessons we're now learning about the perils of credit, my guess is that when this crisis is over, be it in 5 years or around the time of the next ice age, we'll go back to our debting ways. Why? For one thing, we have short memories in this country. For another, we're tireless believers in the American way of life and the plastic that makes it possible.
Megan Daum is a novelist and a columnist for the Los Angeles Times.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. Marketplace Money is supported by SaveAndInvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at SaveAndInvest.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we tackle your money questions. And with me, once again, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
First up, we have Susan on the phone from Old Chatham, New York. Hi, Susan.
Hi there.
So how old is Old Chatham?
Very, very old. Probably 17-something or other.
Nice. Nice. That is pretty old, isn't it?
And it is lovely in Old Chatham.
Oh, you've been there, haven't you? Good, good.
Well, I haven't. I'll have to make it there someday. So what can we do for you today?
Well, I am a realtor, and of course, right now, there's not much going on, and so I'm basically unemployed.
Yeah.
And I realize that we are the forgotten group when you hear all these numbers about unemployed people, but we can't get unemployment. At least I think we can't.
Can realtors, self-employed people, get unemployment, Chris?
The basic answer is no. If you file a Schedule C, if you are self-employed, the unemployment insurance system isn't designed for you. And the theory is, and I think you'll like this, Susan, is the theory is, well, because you're self-employed and you're independent, of course, you can choose whether to work or not to work. And I'm imagining that you're rolling your eyes and thinking, maybe my clients are determining that I'm not working.
That's right.
Having said that, giving the general overview, I would still check with every state because there may be a twist or a turn. You may qualify for something. So I would go to your State Department of Labor website and just check it out. And then I would, if you have a CPA or you have an accountant, you know, really help you go through your taxes. And hopefully that's where you can get some real tax benefits because you've lost income and you've lost business, but you're still working. You still have expenses. So I think the basic thought is for the self-employed person, the real benefit will come on the tax side.
Okay.
Chris, why don't self-employed people get the unemployment benefits?
You know, I think to a large extent, the law moves very, very slowly. I think the basic way to think about our current unemployment system is to go back to the 1950s, 1960s, when Smokestack America, you know, General Electric, U.S. Steel, you know, these defined the business relationship in our country. And the unemployment insurance system was largely written reflecting that environment. Now we're in an environment where so many people put out a shingle. They call themselves a consultant. They're self-employed. And the system hasn't caught up with them yet.
So, Susan, it sounds like we don't have much good news for you.
No, you don't. Well, I feared as much. I feared as much.
But good question. So thanks for calling in.
Not at all. Thank you.
All right. Well, up next, we have an email from Maxine in Danvers, Massachusetts, or should I say Danvers? How was that? How was my Massachusetts accent? I've lost it since I lived there about 8 years ago.
I guess, is that experience talking, I guess? Yes.
Apparently not anymore. But she has a question about one of your favorite products, Chris, the iBond.
Yes.
She says every 6 months or so, she downloads the redemption values for her iBonds. And usually she sees them increase, but she just went on this month. There was no increase at all. What is going on here?
The U.S. Treasury came out with its announcement for inflation-linked bonds bought between May and October. They're going to earn 0% interest for the first 6 months. And when your bonds reset, those people already own them and they reset during this period of time, you will earn the same 0%.
Hey, that sounds great. Wait a minute. What? I thought bonds were supposed to be the place to go.
Let me explain what's going on here. Now, remember that the yield on an iBond, there are two components, right? One part is linked to changes in the consumer price index, the CPI.
Inflation.
Inflation. Now, inflation has been running at almost minus 6%.
Wow.
You can't get a negative yield, so they're going to pay you zero. The second component, that fixed rate. Guess what the fixed rate is, Tess?
Zero.
Not quite.
0.25%?
No, less than that. 0.1%.
Oh, good Lord.
However, I still like iBonds.
Why? Isn't it basically at this point the same as putting the money under the mattress?
Ah, however, with everything that the Federal Reserve is doing, putting all this money out into our system to prevent a great deflation. A year from now, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, we may have a real bout of inflation. The I bond is a hedge against that happening. Remember, you can own this for 30 years.
All right. So once again, this is buy and hold is what we're talking about.
It's a buy and hold, and there's no risk in terms of losing money unless you believe the U.S. government's going to go belly up, and I don't.
There you go, Maxine. Thanks for writing in. Well, if you feel like your financial life is going nowhere, kind of like those I bond interest rates, give us a call, ask a question. We'll try to send you in the right direction. The number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or send us an email. You can do that by clicking on the Getting Personal link at marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more questions later in the program. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We've been talking to listener Gail George every week since the beginning of the month as she conducts a little life experiment for all of us. She's tracking her expenses for 30 days as a kind of first step toward creating a budget. Hi, Gail.
Hi, Tess.
So one more week down and one to go. Describe for us just how detailed you're getting at this point and how you're tracking that spending.
I did create an online one-page monthly budget on a spreadsheet that I just got from something on the internet.
Huh.
I like it. I think if I was really going to be within the penny, I'd probably like to personalize it a little bit for expenses that apply to me and things that don't.
Uh-huh.
However, it is nice to be able to zero out some of those budget items so that I, you know, things that I don't have, like a car payment. I kind of think of that as saving money.
Absolutely. So when you're doing this, for example, when you go to the grocery store, do you just hang on to that receipt and then maybe a couple days later enter it? Or, I mean, take us through kind of your daily, how you do this.
I don't do it daily.
Okay.
I found it, I did the first week, but I think what was easiest for me was that I just took all the receipts that I got
mm-hmm.
and collected them.
And what if you paid for something with cash?
I primarily don't.
Okay.
I primarily use my debit card.
Oh, okay.
I guess that is cash, but I like tracking that. And, of course, it's online banking. You can look at it instantly and see where things have gone. And I even put a little note in my wallet that says, do I need this?
Oh, wow. And is that working for you?
Yeah. It makes me reflect, you know, when I'm buying things, do I really need to purchase things? And also when I go home and look at the receipts and I kind of think, I put it in this category of, you know, you really didn't need to have that item.
I love your idea of putting that little note. I think I might have to try that myself.
Oh, good. Good. Let me know how it works for you.
I will. I will. Wait, would you mind telling us how much money you've spent so far this month? Do you know?
Well, that's not an item that I'm going to be able to give you.
In general, are you surprised or is it kind of what you expected it to be?
I'm not surprised. No, I'm not surprised by any of it.
Okay.
Except, well, I guess food I find constantly surprising.
And how about the time that it's taking you to track all this stuff? I know you're not doing it daily anymore, but do you find that it's manageable?
Yeah, it's manageable. I wouldn't want to spend any more time on it than this, but I think you have to give it enough time so that you're really aware of what you're doing on a day-in and day-out basis.
Well, Gail, thanks again, and you are in the home stretch now. We'll talk to you one more time next week.
Thank you so much, Tess.
If you're unemployed, you may be spending a lot more time online, not tweeting about Adam Lambert's loss, but posting resumes and skill sets and work samples to find a new job.
Help Dave find work following his layoff, and there's a link to my LinkedIn profile.
We'll explore social networking for the unemployed up next on Marketplace Money. We'll be right back. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. Here's an upside-down way of looking at all the recent layoff news. The stigma is pretty much gone from the pink slip. Now, I'm not saying it's fun, but no one is going to bat an eye when they see the entry on your Facebook page, "Hey everyone, change of status, I'm unemployed." This is the first recession, really, since the explosion of social media. As Kurt Nickisch reports from WBUR in Boston, people are also using those social networks to get hired.
Dave Atkins was working from home the day his boss called. Company meeting. Half the people at a small internet startup were going to lose their jobs.
I happened to be on Twitter at the time. I said, "Hey, it looks like I'm getting laid off." Immediately, people started looking for ways to help me.
He blogged about it, too. He posted his resume and recommendations on a professional networking website.
"Help Dave find work following his layoff," and there's a link to my LinkedIn profile.
Now, Atkins spends hours each day at his computer, which chirps with new email and instant messages. He says his job search isn't that different from the old-fashioned way. Networking online just makes it easier.
"I'm having lots of meetings with people, but now I think the meetings are better because sometimes you just really connect with people through a shared interest that wouldn't be obvious from just cold calling them on the phone or just meeting them in person with no context."
According to networking consultant Diane Darling, Atkins has the modern job search down.
"What I call hybrid networking, and it's where you combine online and offline networking."
It helps that Atkins works in tech, but no matter what color your collar, Darling says, social media can help you find opportunities. It also helps employers find out more about you.
"Before Google, there was gossip. You had no idea. Now you can get a little bit of a better sense of what people are saying. And I think it's important that you manage that, your own reputation."
And there's another reason managing the job search could be hard without social networks. Ted Challoner runs a Boston recruiting firm. He says many companies that are hiring right now, they're not even posting their positions, because if they do, they just get swamped with applications.
"Getting it from the thousands and thousands to the 20 or 10 or 5, I think is the problem that companies are facing."
So in order to find a job, Challoner says you may have to use social networks just to find a job opening first. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
We are back with more Getting Personal, and I'm joined by our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, first we have Andrew on the phone in Baltimore. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Well, tell us what your question is for Chris today.
"My wife and I both work. We have life insurance, and we have an 18-month-old boy. And an insurance agent is trying to convince me that something catastrophic could happen to me and that disability insurance might be something that I need. Now, my wife and I, we both were physicians. I work for a university. She works for the health department. One thought is that if something catastrophic happened, the other person could step up their income and kind of step in and make up the difference. I already have some disability with my job that would pay 60%. So I don't know if this is a good way of looking at things or if I should just go ahead and pay for the disability insurance."
You have a policy already that provides 60%.
Yes.
So that's actually your baseline. And for anyone who's listening to this, disability insurance is really important. But in your case, it's whether or not you're going to get that additional coverage. And that, to me, is a more complicated question.
Yeah, because the insurance agent, he can come up with story after story of doom and gloom, things that have happened to people. And it really makes it hard to make the decision.
So here's the big issue that you need to confront. One is, does it have what's called own occupation? In other words, you have a certain specialty. It will cover you even though you're still a doctor, but you're doing something different.
Yeah, and this policy has own occupation.
Okay, so that's key. And then how long does it last? And then the other thing which we all deal with, and Tess and I, you know, whenever we're talking to people, we deal with this all the time, the alternative uses of money. I mean, if you just save this money, would that make as much sense as buying this particular insurance policy for the extra layer of disability protection? The other question that I would be pursuing is I'd really turn to an expert to actually look at the policy itself. One of the things that's really become true in the whole financial services industry, whether we're talking about credit cards or disability insurance, is what's the language? Do you really understand what's going on in terms of the particular policy?
Yeah, because these things are so complicated. It's just pages and pages of legal terms.
But I think it's worth paying an expert to look at it and really lay out for you, here's what are the trade-offs, here's why you're going to do it, or to simply say, you know what, the safety net that you've kind of evolved, one of you might go to work, get a higher paying job, I know there are risks to that, but it's a perfectly reasonable approach.
That help you out?
Yeah, that's really helpful. I just need to have somebody look at it and interpret all that legal financial stuff.
Well, thanks so much for the call.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. All right, Chris, next we have an email from Leslie in Boulder, Colorado, and her son graduated college and was lucky enough to land an entry-level job in his field, but guess what I'm going to say next?
Well, I have a feeling in light of the tough economy that we're living through.
Yep, he's getting laid off just a few months after starting the job. Apparently, he has already been planning to go to graduate school, but thought he might work a couple of years, pay off his undergrad debt, and then go. The bottom line here, $91,000 for a four-year doctorate program. She says there's not a whole lot of hope for a scholarship. So mom is wondering, I mean, how do you know kind of when's the right time to go ahead and try to get another 4 years of education?
All right. You're going to take on this debt. It's going to open up a career for you. This career actually may justify it. May. That's the key word. It may justify all this debt. Then again, not everyone's going to get the job that pays for it. What probably makes more sense in this particular situation, work for a couple of years, add to your savings, and if you are going on to get some sort of PhD in academia, you know, go for a program where they pay you, not you pay them. You know, you start investigating the different graduate school programs. That may take some time. It's a combination of what's the downside, what kind of income can you reasonably expect, what kind of debt burden are you taking on, and how much is that going to take out of your monthly income once you graduate, and are there alternatives that are cheaper?
All right. Hope that helps, Leslie, and good luck to your son. Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take for this week's show, but you can ask us a question anytime. Just call and leave a message at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or write to us. You'll find a link for getting personal at marketplace.org, and that's also where you'll find all kinds of answers that Chris has already put on his blog. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
My pleasure, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And now let's turn to a few of your comments about the show. Last week, we went in search of what retirement might look like in the future. Will it be the stereotypical image of Sun City, Arizona, where golf carts rule the streets and children are neither seen nor heard? Or will it be something else? Cedar Moss wrote in from Chico, California, to express her disappointment with our coverage. You did not talk culturally about what it means to separate elders and children and the terrible loss to both, she says. Martha Crotty of Asheboro, North Carolina, called in to tell us her parents were some of the first residents of Sun City in the 1960s.
It always depressed me to visit them there, and I vowed I'd never live in such a place. It worked for them until they got sick and their family was far away.
But Dennis Anderson of Wayzata, Minnesota, sings the praises of the Sun City model. He writes that retirement communities give similar-minded and similar-aged people a place to live. Also last week, Chris Farrell said we're all going to have to get used to the idea of working longer and postponing retirement. Chris better take the needle out of his arm, writes Eileen Klinkenbeard of California. Okay, well, Eileen is understandably upset. She was laid off at age 63. You just try getting hired after age 50 and see where it gets you, she writes. Our recent feature on Teach for America prompted Big Apple resident Paul Reese to chime in. He was part of a precursor program called the Urban Teacher Corps and then taught for 31 years in a Harlem elementary school. but he doesn't see that kind of commitment today.
Teach for America teachers at my school struggled when they first came, and even those who lasted a full 2 years then left. They had learned much and padded their resumes. I wish I could say that the kids at my school had gained as much.
A few weeks ago, we spent a lot of time talking about issues of credit and how we turned into a nation of borrowers. Eric Janizelli of Greenville, Michigan, had this reaction.
After listening to your special show on debt, I wondered if all Marketplace listeners and participants make poor financial decisions. You may not realize it, but it is rare to hear about anyone doing something financially correct on your show.
Point taken, Eric. We'll get more success stories in the mix. And finally, our congratulations to the students at Estes Park Elementary School in Colorado. Fifth grade teacher Lynn Nichols heard our story about Operation Once in a Lifetime, a Texas nonprofit that provides everything from bed linens to airfare home for military service members around the world. Nichols' school decided to hold an old-fashioned bake sale, and they raised $300, with every penny going to help the soldiers. If you've got something to say to us, write it up. You can comment on any of our stories at marketplace.org. You know the basic rules of investing. Keep your eyes on the long term, diversify your portfolio. Yeah, well, at this point, it's hard not to notice that even if you did everything right, lots went wrong, despite all the assurances from Wall Street types that if you followed the rules, you'd be okay. So, what now? Well, first, you might fire your broker, which is what Jeffrey Goldberg writes about in a recent article in The Atlantic magazine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So here's the line that caught my eye right off the bat. You say, I took a random walk down Wall Street and got hit by a bus. Tell us about that.
I was like a lot of people. I thought that I had an investment strategy that worked. I read what I thought needed to be read, including that book, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and some of the Warren Buffett writing. And it was only, you know, in September or October of last year that I realized that the game is being played at two different levels on Wall Street. And at the high level are the people who know what's going on. And at the other level are the people who don't really know what's going on.
Right, the rest of us.
Don't have the, meaning, you know, approximately the 100 million other Americans who are involved in the stock market in even some peripheral way. It's a very dangerous game to play, and you wind up getting periodically hit by a bus.
You write that we all did not have a proper appreciation for risk. Why didn't people understand that they could lose all this money?
You know, I think of myself, I'm in my early 40s, and I think of myself and my generation as children of the bull market. We don't really have experience with long downturns. You know, there were dips and there were valleys, but you always sort of climbed right out of them. And so you don't really get the point that you could get wiped out in a matter of days, not months, but days.
So your approach was to get a lot of different views, and you started with Richard Bernstein, chief investment strategist at Merrill Lynch. What did he tell you?
I called him in part because I had my money at Merrill Lynch, and we had this conversation, and he underscored for me the fact that he was bearish for a while before this crash. I told him that I never got the sense that Merrill Lynch was communicating to me that the bears are out and you guys should probably get out of those financial stocks that you're in. I had, you know, 150 shares of AIG and 200 shares of Citibank or whatever it's called. So I said to Bernstein, I said, pardon me for asking this, but if you were so bearish, why weren't you yelling, hey, by the way, these financial stocks are built on toothpicks? And he said, I didn't want to go running around saying sell, sell, sell. That would have been irresponsible. And I was like, excuse me, but if you had said sell, sell, sell a year ago to me, one of your clients, I might have sold.
Well, you talk about
And I'm not, by the way, I'm not, you know, this is not a blame thing. I consider myself lucky for any number of reasons, including the fact that I have a job. This is, and I blame only myself. We are in charge of our own money. So I'm not blaming Richard Bernstein for not holding my hand and walking me through the garden with all the serpents in it.
Okay, so you ate the apple all on your own. But
I didn't get any knowledge, did I?
Right.
And it said bye.
But so many people listen to what you talk about as, you know, the hot tips that you're getting from your financial institution. They're really not caring about you at that point.
Their job is to make money. They make money through inefficiencies in the market. What are the inefficiencies in the market? They're us. Right. They're the people who don't know to get out when the getting's good. I mean, going back to Richard Bernstein from Merrill Lynch for a second, what really sort of ticked me off was a piece of advice he issued on the Merrill Lynch website several months ago, in which he said that one investment strategy in these difficult times is to, quote, elongate your time horizon, to which I respond, borrowing from Keynes, in the long run, we're all dead. I had an elongated time horizon. I got into the market 15 years ago. I consider myself marginally wiser for having now this experience and having this information at my hands, which is that, you know, you should pick a financial advisor the way you would pick an oncologist. I mean, you don't sort of randomly pick an oncologist because your friend says, oh, this oncologist is great. He cures cancer. You shouldn't pick a financial advisor because somebody says, oh, yeah, he's really smart. He made me 12% last year.
But there are plenty of people who did that research, who really did trust
their financial advisors.
But I want to go to this extraordinary quote that you have in the piece from Seth Klarman, who wrote the book on investing called Margin of Safety.
Guy.
He says outright to you that the average person can't trust anybody, not their broker, not a mutual fund. That's really depressing because most of us have become convinced that if we don't have money in the markets, that we're never going to have enough of it to, say, retire or send the kid to college.
Well, what you have to do is elongate your time horizon, I
apparently
think.
Apparently I do, yes.
Apparently it's about 200 years. I don't blame somebody for giving me advice that turns out to be wrong. You know, predicting the future is very hard because it hasn't happened yet. But do I trust? No, but you know what? This is the problem here is that if you're going to do this, if you're going to look for the 8% return, 10% return, 12% return with a financial advisor, you have an obligation to stay on top of the situation and do your own reading and bring your own skepticism to the table. But of course, that takes time and a willingness to learn about matters that are arcane and boring sometimes.
The article is called What Now? It's the cover story from the May issue of The Atlantic. And Jeffrey Goldberg's been talking with us, and it's been awfully fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, the story of a California couple whose bank gave them a mortgage, then 3 days later, yanked their credit line. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Tro. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.